Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with Ray McClure. At age 95, he is still a Gold Seal certified flight instructor. But in World War II, he was flying B-17s with the 452nd Bomb Group in Europe. He told us how the African-American pilots flying red-tailed P-51 escorts for him earned his utmost respect, those Tuskegee Airmen helping to chase off German fighter planes. But when those German fighters left, he knew the flak was about to begin.
When they left, we would all spread out like crazy. I mean, you know, half a mile between airplanes because that flak comes up. We didn't want two or three airplanes going down with one burst of flak, if you can follow that. But that was the reasoning behind that. And those German fighters, by the way, when they would come in, if they were on level with you or before climbing for you, just before they got into you, they would flip over upside down. And the reasoning for that was if they got in trouble, they could, I don't know if you know what a split S is or not, they could split S out fast. I mean, really, you know, you're going straight down right now, whereas if they were right side up, they would either have to punch it over, which would take time, or climb to get out of the deal. And our gunners would get them. Boy, those boys of mine, those kids were really good. And everybody had a gun, you know, when we got into that mess. They were on a gun. The radio operator, they all had assigned guns. And most of them had double 50s. That's why they flipped upside down, so they could split us and get the hell out of there. So anyway, we would keep going and knew, you know, we'd start hitting that flak. And I hated that flak. They didn't ask me, but I would have told them right away, I do not like flak. Because, you know, you see this black poof, that's all you see. But boy, there is shrapnel flying in all directions like crazy. And those flak shells were set to where they would explode at a certain altitude. This is what exploded them. Well, we would change altitude ever so often, up and down and around, trying to evade it, but you know, you can't evade all of it. The dangerous part of that mission was at the last part, when you were going for the target, it had to be straight and level for the bombardier to get on the target, because when he toggled his switch, dropped his bomb, everybody dropped their bombs. I mean, we saturated the town. We didn't care whether there was a hospital, a school, whatever. But all those people knew we were coming, and most of them were in a deal where it sheltered them. So, you know, we were hitting empty buildings and stuff. But we were out to win a war, not win a popularity contest. We were out to win a war, and so we tried to win it, and we did. But that was good. But on one deal, the only thing that really happened to me, besides a few bullet holes in the skin of the B-17, was on the way home, the number three engine, they went from left to right, one, two, three, and four. And the number three engine caught on fire. I don't know how or why or anything. I think maybe they might have tagged an oil tank or something in it. And each engine had its own fire retardant. Well, the co-pilot boy and I, we tried to put that fire out, and we tried, and we tried, and, you know, I even thought about asking for volunteers to walk out there with the fire extinguishers, but I didn't think I'd get any volunteer. But anyway, the thing bad about an engine fire is behind that engine is the wing spar, and that's what holds the wing on and, you know, keeps it stiff and, you know, real neat. And anyway, it kept on and on, and we ran out of fire retardant, and we were still way out over the water. And I told the crew, I says, well, you know, you guys can start bailing out if you want. I'll notify the boat boys to come out and pick you up, because we dropped out of formation. So, you know, everybody knew we were in trouble because we didn't want to hold them up, and we were a lot slower than they were. And so they asked me what I was going to do. And I said, well, I'm not going to jump out of a perfectly good airplane with three engines running. I said, but you can rest assured if that wing starts to look like it's going to buckle or something, because, you know, I figured that a lot of times the spar got hot and, you know, would start coming apart. And getting out of a B-17 that's out of control was just almost impossible. It was really bad. And so they says, no, we'll ride in with you. So, you know, to make a long story short, we made it. We got it home all right. And I don't think they ever used that airplane again, though. I think we did enough damage or had enough damage that they did it. But then that was really, other than just, you know, getting holes in the airplane, that was about it for World War II.
Let's talk about that. Why don't you tell everybody how many men are on your plane? How many men are in your crew?
Usually there was 10 men in the crew. The tail gun had double 50s, belly gun had double 50s, and the upper turret had double 50s, and there was double 50s out the nose. The waist guns each had a gun apiece because they had a lot of action going there. They were moving a lot, you know, trying to trace these guys. They were pretty good, but the one guy that really, really, I used to shudder about it, our belly turret. This is a turret that hangs down quite a ways below the airplane's belly because the guy had to have a shot at the fighters coming in and everything. So it hung down along. Well, if you caught some bullets in there, you got that turret to where it wasn't moving or anything, and you had the belly of an airplane in, that turret gun on the belly turret gun was going to get ground to meat. You know, he was a dead man, that's all. You just, oh, they never seemed to think about that. I thought about it a lot, but didn't seem to bother them at all.
Well, that's what I was getting at. Yeah, I've talked to guys who they had that gear shot up and they couldn't retract the turret up in there, and some tense moments. But I'm thinking tense moments for you, because these aren't strangers to you. You've gotten to know this crew a little bit, right?
Yes, it is. You know, these guys were part of your family practically, you know. And so if one of them got hurt or something, I never did get any of them hurt or killed, thank heavens. It would have really, really made me feel bad, real bad.
Well, and that mission you were describing. So you've been hit, your engine's on fire. Oh. Everything you try, you can't put the fire out. And you're coming back over the English Channel not knowing if you're going to make it or not. So how much of a burden do you carry in those moments for those other guys on your plane?
Well, I ordered them to jump, you know, when we first started in, and I realized how bad this situation is, but they wouldn't. So I felt pretty good about that they would, you know, choose to go in with me.
I guess they must have had a lot of confidence in you as a pilot.
Oh, I don't know about that, but every one of them, every chance I got, I would put a different crew member on the controls in case something happened to me. Someone else could bring the bird in. You know, everybody didn't have to die if just because I was. So I would try to get every one of them as much stick time as I could in the cockpit, and yes, a lot of them could do pretty good. That was something. They were all kids, and you know, it's like they are now playing these video games. You know, they're good at video games, and these guys were good at that too. You know, you tell them something, and you tell them all was going to be well, and they believed you. Mm-hmm. It was not like that, you know.
And so, what was that landing like when you brought it in with that engine fire?
Well, we had it feathered, of course. It wasn't bad at all. The gear came down, which, thank heavens, it came down. And then from then on, it's just a piece of cake. It's just routine. You just come in and land it, you know. And it was a good flying bird. I really liked that airplane. That was a really neat airplane. You could just blow it to pieces and it'd still fly.
How many missions did you fly over there?
21. It wasn't all that big a deal for me. But the one that I hate to say it, but I really had fun in Korea. That was something else. I stayed in the reserve. I did an awful lot of civilian flying. That's what I was doing all the time, was civilian flying. I lived my whole life, seemed like, in a cockpit, my adult life. When I got out of World War II, the officers had the option of what they called an early out. You know, the war was over and everything, and they had officers running out their ears, and they wanted to get rid of us. So I'd been flying four-engine bombers hundreds of hours. I thought, well, I'll take an early out and go fly for the airlines. They'll want me, You know, boy, here I am, Hotshot Charlie. Come home, go roaring down to all the airlines, all the major airlines I went to. They all told me exactly the same thing. They said, what college did you graduate from? And I said, college? I didn't go to college. You know, I went to war. And they said, well, we want college people. And so they, you know, I was out. My next job was a busboy. So I was a busboy for about 4 or 5 days, I guess. And I finally got my head squared away. And I went back out to the Long Beach airport. And I went to the biggest fixed-based operator on the airport, Randall Scott. Scott Arrow. I told him, I said, I'm just out of the service. I need a job. And he says, well, do you have an instructor's license? I said, well, no. But he says, if you had an instructor's license, I'd put you to work in the morning. You could go to work. And I says, oh, okay. So with that, I went roaring over to the FAA. By this time, it was the FAA. And in those days, you could take the test right there. They'd grade it. And, you know, he either passed or didn't pass. So I went roaring over there. I got a hold of this old inspector who's dead now. Everybody I know is dead now. He sat me down, and I took this instructor's test, written test, and I passed it. So he set me up for a flight the next morning to see if I could fly, you know. I passed that all right. He wrote me out my license right there, the instructor's license, you know. And so then I go over with Scott Arrow and saw old Randall Scott again and waving my new temporary instructor's license. And he says, can you come in the morning? I says, boy, I'll be here bright and early. Just what time? And he says, well, I've got 9 students for you. I said, really? He says, yeah. So that was really the start of my civilian flying career was that, because I had 9 students from in all. I had hundreds of students.
I was going to say, how many students you think you've had since then, over all the years combined?
No, I had hundreds of them. My daughter got her license on her 16th birthday. In fact, we flew her home from the hospital when she was only 3 days old. And my wife got hers on her 21st, got her pilot's license. But I have literally taught hundreds of people to fly.
And who knows, you might be the next. It's break time again, but there's more to come with 95-year-old Ray McClure. Don't forget to check out the photos and video of Ray at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.